Welcome to the long overdue episode 12 of the Service Course Report podcast. My name's Ed Philbrick. I'm joined by Kurt and Darren Stockton. We had a little hiatus, we'll call it the Thanksgiving break, but we're back. Today we're doing a little bit more of a freeform conversation, but just a reminder that we're on Spotify with video, YouTube with video and audio. You know, it depends on how you like it. We're also on Apple Podcasts and Amazon Podcasts for audio only. So what's up? What have you guys been up to in the last month since we chatted?
Man, there's been like a respectable amount going on. I would say one cool thing that Kurt and I did is we had a family function up in Napomo, and we were able to take advantage and go ride that Pismo Preserve that you had ridden, Ed, and talked about on the previous pod, and I further what you said is that whole riding area is really fantastic. It's literally about 1 minute off the 101. You just pull over, nice big parking lot, just like you said. You know, there's pay app, you can park, $5 basically gets you all day. And Kurt and I went and rode our gravel bikes up there, and it was pretty super. You know, the trails were really well built, some fun little berms and stuff, but it wasn't so rocky or, you know, braking bumped out that you couldn't totally get away with it on a gravel bike, which is what Kurt and I did. So I really had a fun time doing that. What do you think, KS?
Yeah, I mean, well, I would say other than that, the one thing that has happened since we last recorded, obviously, is that I stopped shaving. But yeah, that was, what I call very gravel bike friendly single track. There were some steep little pitches, but nothing you can't ride up. But to your point, DS, there were no rocks. This riding single track can sometimes be a little bit, if you don't do that a lot on a gravel bike, it can kind of, be a little unnerving for some people. But it was like, it was so spectacular. The biggest challenge was to keep your eyes off of the views and keep your eyes on the trails, because we were very fortunate that we had a super clear day. And so, as you mentioned, it's right off of the 101 there. Parking lot's a little bit higher, and then everything is up above. So all the trails go up, and then you get on that ridge up there. You're looking down over the Pacific, and you kind of don't even see the highway. But then when you get to the top, also you look out, look east and look back on the valley back there. Yeah, it was really pretty cool, and we were like, we had to kind of, unfortunately had to get out of there, but we would have definitely like done a whole nother loop of it. You could ride the whole thing we did in two directions. Great multi-purpose trails. We saw a lot of people out, walking that day. And that was a Saturday that we rode. And it looked to me like, there was a bunch of equestrian parking. I'm guessing the equestrians probably spend more time during the week when you don't get as many people on foot or on bikes. But it seemed like the multi-purpose part of it was pretty well thought out. And I mean, we even had the little section where you went and we popped up over a little section where the cows were, it was free range there. Yeah. For a little part the trail went through. So you did have to dodge a few road apples, but it's good to keep your head up because you don't want that stuff flying up off your front wheel. But yeah, it was awesome. I think that was really cool. I'm looking forward to riding that again. And if you're ever driving through Pismo, literally it's right there. Like the effort is so minimal. It was very, very cool.
Yeah. And I think gravel bike, if you're used to riding stuff a little more than fire roads, and also if you have like an XCO bike, a good cross country bike, which was what you rode it with, Ed, I think either of those are probably like the two perfect bikes for that preserve.
Yeah. You could even ride it on a road bike if you were just in a pinch.
Yeah. If you were so inclined. And we did shoot some video, and so we'll get that uploaded and posted up so you guys can check it out. Check out a little bit more video of KS and I ripping around up there. It was a really good time.
I have my GoPro video up on our YouTube account, and I would remind our listeners that we have, a pretty extensive YouTube account, including old clips of KS and DS, that lurk out on the internet. If you want some entertainment, you can find old clips of these guys. The nice thing about the Pismo Preserve is that the hotels participated in it, and there's an affiliate link on the Pismo Preserve website. Like if you want to book a hotel, the Pismo Preserve will make a small slice of your hotel stay. if you book through the Pismo Preserve website, which is kind of a clever cooperative relationship between the businesses and the preserve. Also, the preserve, or the San Luis Obispo Land Conservancy, was right. The principal beneficiary of the Bovine Classic. So all the beer ticket sales at the Sunken Gardens, which, you know, are rumored to be around $10,000, went to the San Luis Land Preserve, which is the conservancy that preserved that area and struck the deal with the hotels and the cattle ranchers and the hikers and the horse people. And you know, they marketed with cycling right on the front of their brochure.
Yeah, that's
some
great.
Some land conservancies are not, you know, so open to mixed use, you know. It depends who donated the money to preserve the land. Sometimes wildlife organizations are not so keen to have, you know, cycling or horseback riding on land that's supposed to be preserved for mountain lions, for example. So this is an example of a mixed use scenario cooperative where it's working, and I think we should all support it and check it out.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially when supporting it is just going up and riding and then to tell people what you think.
And another little thing I crossed my mind is if the parking lot is full, you can park on the other side of the highway. There's a little dirt lot where you can avoid the $5 fee, but the $5 fee is a donation to the Land Conservancy. The cool thing too is, I don't know if you guys have this in Santa Barbara, they had bell boxes where you could just borrow a bike bell because they're required and then just return it with a magnet, like it's stuck on a magnet. I've never seen that. We need that down here in San Diego more.
We have that in Santa Barbara. We've actually had trail bells for, I think, 20 years up here for a long time. Ever since like the early 2000s, there was a bit of when the downhill scene was really booming, in the late 90s and into the early 2000s, there was some conflict between the hikers and the downhillers. There were a couple different bike shops, and it's continued on through, I think, Sage now, which is our biggest nonprofit trail group up here in the area. We have bell boxes up at the top and the bottom. You're supposed to grab it at the top and stick it back in the box at the bottom. So we do have those up here.
Nice.
That's interesting.
All the hikers. Yeah, I was just going to say, to add on to that, all the hikers like the bells. Whenever you're coming down with a bell and you see a hiker, you know, and obviously slowing down a little bit if you're ripping down a trail, you know, as we'll do, slowing down a little bit and paying them a bit of respect, or even stopping and letting them go past. But everybody always thanks us for the bells. So it's a good idea to have one on.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting too, because that's something that we, you know, the few people that I ride with out in the Nevada City area, Chris Foyt and Robin, actually, two of us, but we have a whole network of irrigation ditches around the county, and especially right outside of Nevada City. So these ditches that got put in for the hydraulic mining back in the day and for irrigation, they all have trails alongside of them. And since they're irrigation ditches, they're all on like a 1-2% slope max. So they're basically, they're flat, and they are multi-use as, you know, hikers, runners, and then cyclists. You know, don't get equestrians on those trails. And we took it upon ourselves just to put bells on our bikes, just to make people aware. And that what you were talking about, DS, is the same thing. When you start using that bell, people are so appreciative, you know, and it's not like a trail bell that you turn on or off. I have one that's just a little thumb activated one. But the pitch is so perfect that, you know, I ring that thing and I get people, they're like smiling. Thank you for the bell. Thank you for the bell. Yeah. I also run a flashy light on the front end of my bike so that people can see you, because a lot of where we're riding is, it's got canopy over it. So it's almost all shaded along those ditches. There's a lot of trees. So I think doing that, and it helps with that, having different groups happy to work with each other. You know, like what you were saying, Ed, some conservancies, they don't want bikes, but it's like, all it comes down to really is just people communicating with each other and being open. You know, I always stop when, you know, it's bike, you know, and hikers, you can tell when someone needs you to stop, you know, if they're not used to having bikes come by, you can kind of tell by their body language. Although the one fun little anecdote with the bell, when we started using it, is mostly it's when you're coming up behind someone, right? You want to let them know. And ring your bell, and 9 times out of 10, people would reach for their phone, like, oh, I'm getting an alert. You know, they weren't used to having a bike bell. They were, they were more conditioned to getting alert on their phone, which that one kind of blows me away, is that there are people out, you know, having a nice walk, and they're more concerned about their phone than checking the scenery. But it seems to be changing a little bit. Bells are super helpful. Anything we can do to lower that kind of friction sometimes that we get between two-wheeled travel and not. That's great. Yeah. So that was it. Yeah.
My Garmin 1050 has a bell built into it. And so when I'm on my gravel bike, it's in the lever, so I can hit my lever, the button on the top of my DI2 lever. But on my mountain bike, I have to go and touch the screen to get that electronic bell. And that's just not an easy motion because it's in the center of my bar. So I don't know. I need to purchase a bell. I've been yelled at, no bell, no bell, you know, so my free hub's pretty loud. Anyway, it's interesting. Yeah. It's interesting that we try and keep things positive here. And I think we just laid out a lot of positive mojo, but, you know, an interesting thing happened for me in the last week. I'm on the board of directors for the Escondido Creek Conservancy, and we just closed escrow on, we'll call it 70 acres behind the house here, which is sort of Mecca for the mountain bikers. And it's called Frank's Peak. And I hiked up there with my family with our dog Frankie. So we took Frankie to Frankie's Peak. And, you know, my family ran into mountain bikers coming down off the top. And I was trying to kind of explain to them, like, you know, this is still private property to my family. This is still private property. And, you know, I'm not sure if the mountain bikers are going to continue to be able to access or how that's all going to work out, because it's private property all the different ways. But it's, you know, these preserving land and allowing a cooperative cycling to take place and for us all to coexist is important. So I think we'll continue to put out the positive mojo on that topic. You know, switching gears slightly, the New York Times put out an article about e-bikes that is circulating around. You guys have any opinions about that article or some of the things going on there?
You want to go ahead, Chaos?
Well, I mean, I have not finished that article, but it started us on a topic of conversation before we started recording here. But yeah, I would say, DS, you've thought through some of this stuff. Like, you were hitting points, having not read the article, that were in the article. So yeah, have at it.
Yeah, it's something that I've seen in this area. And, you know, and as especially between the three of us, as I'm the one who has an electric mountain bike, you know, like a Mondrake or like more of a performance bike, I have a lot of thoughts about it. And I've seen the proliferation of e-bikes, you know, around town where I live in the Carpinteria, Santa Barbara area. And I think that the biggest, you know, there's a couple different issues, but the biggest one I see is with the class twos. And so for people who don't know, they've been designated three classes of e-bikes. There's class one, which has a 20-mile-per-hour limit, and that's a pedal assist, so you have to pedal it to make it work. There's class two, which also has a 20-mile-per-hour limit, but you don't have to pedal those to make them go. They have a throttle assist, so you can just turn it and coast and go. And then they have class three, which is a 28-mile-an-hour limit. And those also are pedal assists. So you have to pedal them. And where I see, you know, the major problem is that I've seen with kids, a lot of kids riding them around town, is with the class twos. And the class twos, you know, I feel from what I've seen, as soon as you don't have to use the pedals, whether you have a motor assist or not, if you don't have to use pedals to make the bike go, in my eyes, that's not a bicycle anymore. It's not an e-bike. And when I see kids riding on those, when they can just twist the throttle and they're kind of like hanging out on the side and they're looking at their phone, those are people that I've seen almost accidents. I've come up on accidents where kids have hit cars. And from you guys telling me that was a big topic in the New York Times article, talking about, you know, injuries and even fatalities, not only for the people on the bikes, but pedestrians getting hit. And so I think back to when I was, you know, a kid and, you know, a teenager, which I don't really see them anymore, but they used to have, you know, whatever you want to call it, a vehicle called a moped. And my best friend JT, his older brother Steve, had one, and we would use that. And a moped was something that it actually had pedals on it. They were usually a little 50cc two-stroke engine, and you had to use the pedals to kind of get it up and going. But then once it was going, you could just use the throttle and ride it. So it was basically just a little 50cc, you know, motorcycle. And
you know,
the
irony about those was the bike shops were selling those open air bicycles. Sold was a principal moped dealer in Santa Barbara, and the brands were Motocon, French brand, and Pooch.
Yeah, Pooch. Yeah,
Pook.
Pook. Pooch.
So it was interesting.
Yeah,
it was interesting. Yeah, I just divert you just slightly. Interesting that the bike. I think there were moped stores as well, but the bike stores were principal retailers of those. So some of this confusion dates back to that period of time in a way. I forgot what I was going to say, but mopeds were huge. You know, like
right,
they were everywhere. Anyway, continue on with what you were saying.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And I'd forgot that open air carried those. Well, I just think the main thing is that in order to ride a moped, you had to have your driver's permit. So you had to be, you know, within at our age, 15 and a half in order to be able to use a moped. And so I feel like class 2 e-bikes shouldn't really fall under regulation of bicycles. They should be called like an e-ped or something and fall under the same distinction that mopeds used to, which is you've got to be 15 and a half. You've got to have a learner's permit in order to operate one. And, normally the e-bike argument that I see, you know, where safety comes into place is normally, let's say in order to ride a bike, you know, up a hill or get yourself into a position where something bad could happen if you went screaming down a hill or got your speed up, normally you had to ride it enough that you had to be good enough to get up the hill. And so along that learning process, you would learn some skills and basic things. And when we were kids, it seemed like everybody rode a bike around. But these days, if you could just go out and just not have any cycling experience and hop on something that all of a sudden you're going 20 miles an hour without having to pedal or really think about it, you don't understand speeds and how to adjust for it. And I mean, anybody knows you don't think 20 miles an hour is that fast. But if you were driving in your car and hit something at 20 miles an hour that was fixed, it would be catastrophe. Your airbag would go off. You'd be thrown up against the front, could get injured. And so I think that the regulation does need to change on those. And take those class twos and turn them into a different designation.
Yeah. The Surons, the little mini
motorcycles,
those things are brutal. I start to see their impact on the trail because there's like these burnout ruts, like where you, like someone digs a trough like this because clearly they were running the throttle and it makes these little like troughs.
But yeah.
The Surons bring another level. They're huge around here, and the Rangers can't chase them down because they're so fast. And, I think the Suron to me looks like an incredible machine. Is there anything better as far as a riding experience? It looks incredible, but it's, I don't know, the wheelie culture of Surons. Like, we had a huge conflict on TikTok where some adults got into a shoving match here with a group of Surons, you know, patrolling.
Yeah.
The conflict has gotten pretty intense. San Marcos, where I live, just passed an ordinance. They're the second city in San Diego County to pass an ordinance. No one under 12 is allowed on an e-bike. Not allowed, I believe, I'd have to verify this, a second rider, although I still see the second rider. And then you're not allowed to be on the sidewalk. I always assumed we were never allowed on the sidewalk anyway on a bicycle. But there are posted signs here in the town center of the commercial district. I think they're emphasizing in the commercial zones they can't be on the sidewalk. And then a friend messaged me and he said, "Hey, I just saw the sheriff pull over a pack of 15 e-bikers that were zooming across the lanes." So, you know, maybe the sheriff's going to start enforcing things. I think one of the things is you can have all these laws and rules, but no one's enforcing it. So,
right.
Anyway.
Yeah, I think those are all valid points. And the Surons, which for people who don't know, is basically just a motorcycle that's powered by electricity and not gas. It would be like the same as my little Honda 150 trail bike I have, but actually they're way faster and way more performance driven. And so just because that has an electric motor, you know, it allows people to go without detection because you don't hear it. like you would a normal, you know, a normal gas motor, but those shouldn't be allowed, you know, anywhere on like a normal cycling trail. If a dirt bike's not allowed on it, then a Suron shouldn't be allowed on it, in my opinion.
Yeah. And I was go ahead.
Oh, is Suron a brand?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. It's a brand.
In the New York Times article, there's a picture of a Suron with a kid on the back.
Yeah. Is that the image right at the very start of the article? Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw a kid. That is so funny. You mentioned the wheelie culture. I finished a ride yesterday in Truckee. I'm up in Tahoe right now, and we got done and just went into the garage. We're barely in there, and we saw a kid came by doing a wheelie right down in front of the house, you know, just down the middle of the road. And then he turned right onto the next street, didn't even look through. Like, how can you tell there's not a car coming? It was like, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, there is that little feeling of invincibility when you're younger. But from our experience, a car wins 10 times out of 10 when you're on a two-wheeler. Yeah,
but also, you know, a cool thing about all this is, and we can debate the skills that these kids are developing, is that you guys were incredible bike racers and ultimately downhill racers, both of you, because you grew up balancing on two wheels right off of training wheels, right?
Yeah.
You guys have incredible balance skills because of motorcycles, because of bicycles. And, you know, kids that were on scooters in the skate park, you know, all of a sudden in the 2000s,
right,
scooters were a thing, and we're like, oh, we're not going to develop skateboarders anymore because kids are on these dumb little scooters, you know,
right.
Like these kids are going to develop crazy skills. And they're just living their life like we used to live it, you know? So
yeah.
I think it's really important. Like we're not, you know, we were these kids.
Absolutely.
So,
we were those kids, but I still didn't take my YZ80 and just rip it around town in traffic. You know, maybe a few late nights I snuck out with JT and we went riding on Mountain Drive in the dark. But other than those, you know, few times, you know, it was pretty much known if you were going to go ride that bike, you had to find a proper place. And that's the whole point. I mean, I've had a great, you know, not only grew up, as you mentioned, you know, us riding dirt bikes and then working as a trainer in motocross. I'm not at all against motorcycles. I love them. I think they're great. You know, getting out on dirt bikes and riding is super fun. I mean, it's some of the most fun I had as a kid. And even as an adult, when I still go out and ride on have my little Trail 150, I just think, man, that thing is so much fun. But I don't start it up and just go ripping around the neighborhood, you know, not looking at traffic and zinging through. That's just that's a safety issue.
And the other thing, an education thing. Yeah. I can't go anywhere without someone engaging me in a conversation about e-bikes and bike paths. And we were having an e-bike discussion here, but one of the things that happened in Carlsbad and Encinitas is we had two fatalities. And when those fatalities happened, the cities instantly declared states of emergency so that they could spend money in ways that they wouldn't have been able to otherwise. And they put up, you know, more green paint, more green designated lanes, more plastic bollards, whatever the proper pronunciation of that probably French word is. And, you know, they made these designated spaces and then everyone wants to debate those, you know, like, where can I ride? How's my car going to pull over in traffic? And then some of them had like these asphalt berms. City of Vista spent millions of dollars putting those in and then voted to take them out because, you know, it became a firebrand topic of, well, how am I supposed to pull my car out of traffic if I'm in an auto repair scenario? You know, how am I supposed to pull over? So, you know, it's a complex issue.
Right, right. Yeah. One that I'm sure we'll continue to hear about into the future, but maybe at least getting the dialogue going and have people recognizing it is always the first step.
Well, it's always unfortunate someone has to get hurt for the dialogue really to go, right? I mean, that's the main crux of that NYT article was accidents and a doctor in Marin County, like seeing all these accidents happening with the proliferation of e-bikes that weren't around before that e-bike thing happened. And he noticed, if I'm remembering correctly, that there was no designation between an acoustic bicycle crash and an electric bicycle crash. And then they started to break that out. And that's where he saw the, you know, a big difference, because it wasn't, no one was separating those. And then once the data is there, it's like, okay. I mean, sadly, people have to get hurt, you know, young children are getting hurt, and, you know, pedestrians that are out minding their own business. Pedestrians and cars has always been a thing. I mean, it is a hot button topic too. I think that you're talking about, Ed, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. And sometimes it takes away from other things, but it has been an issue for a while. And it will be interesting to see how it all works out. You know, people are, we don't want more regulation,
We've had two fatalities on bike paths here in San Diego in the last 6 months. And then both gentlemen died. Both gentlemen were in their 70s. And both articles and news coverage didn't indicate whether e-bikes were involved, but they were. One was a head-on collision, Lake Murray area, on a bike path, and the other was the Oceanside bike path just this last week. And both of them were males in their 70s,
struck by a bike.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. Oh, the one last week in Oceanside involved an electric scooter. So, anyway.
Yeah.
You know, this is also an issue on bike paths, the safety and the blending of electric versus analog, as you use that word, Cass.
Right. Yeah. Right.
Analog or acoustic. Maybe it's acoustic, right? Yeah. We're thinking of early Dylan and later Dylan, right? You went from acoustic to electric.
I'm sure to be continued on the e-bike topic.
Cass, you listening to any music lately? Like, what's the music of the moment for you?
So a couple of weeks ago, if anyone remembers the 80s hip hop group called Boogie Down Productions, KRS-One, he came through Nevada City, and I went and saw that show a couple of weeks ago, and kind of sparked my interest in some of that stuff that, it was a good buddy of mine, James Urbanus, who I raced bikes with on the same team on 10-speed drive. We did together, and remember James came out to California to train because he lived in Colorado, and he came out and he stayed with us, and he stayed with our buddy Cam Johnson down in the Thousand Oaks area, and introduced DS and I to Public Enemy and the Beastie Boys. You know, that was that first little bit, and then we delved into a lot of that kind of early 80s hip hop, which it's, you know, started in the 70s, but we got into it, and I mean, that was probably what, like, DS, like 85, 86, 87. But it was fun. I actually, when I saw that show was coming to Nevada City, I thought it was like a spoof. I didn't believe it. So I actually looked it up and confirmed the tour before I bought a ticket. But it was fun to go see that, you know, show with maybe 300 people, you know, standing only type of thing, which just got me listening to some of that stuff again, which is... Yeah, always enjoy it. And then it's always funny, you know, you listen to some album and you're like, I know every like change of tune, you know, almost every lyric, you know, which song's coming up next, because, you know, that was a huge way that I got through all those long hours of training was with a Walkman and multiple cassette tapes and even sometimes a second set of batteries when you were going out on long rides, you know, and you just...
Yep.
Right. We might have had a cyclometer, right? A little Avocet cyclometer on your bike that showed you your speed and distance. And maybe you had a heart rate monitor, but mostly it was just about the training. And so you pass the hours and you just listen to that stuff over and over. So that's fun to do that, to listen to those old tunes.
Let's put a marker there. I think both Darren and myself used the early heart rate monitor that was on your forearm that was about this long, the Konkoni thing, and the chest strap pads were about this big. So I think all of us go back pretty far in technology. And Cass, I remember you having a pretty lucrative year or something like that, and you bought a Walkman that was like wireless, and it had like the headphones went to a battery pack that sat here, and then it went down to, you know, like it still had a cord with a battery that was transmitting to another battery. You remember that Walkman that you had that had like it was like early cordless?
Yeah, you know, it was, I think I bought that thing when I went and raced the Worlds in 90 in Japan, because you couldn't find it in the U.S. I had heard about that, and I was like, okay, I was always a little bit of a tech geek, and I had to have that thing, and I may actually still have it now that you mentioned it. It never really worked that well, right? Because it wasn't like it was before Bluetooth, like that connection. Right. I do, you know, it's interesting you bring that one up because I remember riding like through certain places, maybe even over by Lake Casitas in different spots. And I would start picking up weird radio signals through that thing and different sounds. And I'm like, is there like some kind of military installation in the side of the mountain here? You know, what's going on? But I did get that. I even had a very early Discman, but ultimately it was the Sony Sports Walkman was the Walkman of choice. That, remember that yellow one? It was supposedly like waterproof. It would even, you had to sometimes depressurize it. It had a big O-ring around it. But one of the best things about that particular Walkman was that the headset, right, it had basically like little earbuds, where mine went too far, but the piece over the top was just a thin piece of stainless, so it fit underneath your helmet perfectly. Yeah. Like you didn't even know that it was on. This was before earbuds, and maybe the other one I had, but yeah, I mean, we just listened to a ton of tunes. That was how it got through training, and that was And the heart rate monitor tech, because James was the guy that got us into the heart rate monitor, because when his buddy, our buddy Roy Nickman, came back from his first year with Lavi Claire and training under Paul Coakley, brought like this Xerox of a copy of this training, this Coakley training program, and it was all heart rate based back, you know, in 80, 85, 86. So yeah, we bought the Polar. Remember the Polar heart rate monitor? Yeah.
That was the first one.
You put a little piece of foam pipe insulation around your handlebar and like try to cinch that thing down, and it would always slip doing that. Yeah, I even remember, and then I'll spare you the details, but taking a cyclometer mount and grinding the top of it off because the cyclometer slid in and kind of clicked in, and I remember grinding that flat and shoe gooing my Polar monitor to the Avocet mount, so it would actually stay put versus doing the wristband with the phone. But yeah, I guess we were adopters of that early tech just out of necessity. And I have to look back. Yeah, I might have the Coakley Xerox of a Xerox of a Xerox somewhere still as well. So that'd be fun to share.
That would be cool to see that. But Urbanus was he thought differently about music. He probably still does. Because he brought around a lot of music that honestly was a little 80s revolting, like ABC, sort of disco-y type things. Like he had a different switch on music. Like we came up in guitar culture and then Urbanus showed up like, no, you got to listen to this like disco-y weird stuff again. Right, you know, like I
still have those CDs. They're part of my CD grotto, as we like to call it. Yeah. You know, I wanted to say one funny thing about the whole Walkman discussion is a couple of things. One, when we were riding a lot, I think you made it about a season on a Walkman. And I remember when they would break and you would open it up and looking at the inside of it, there were so many moving parts. I'm just amazed that they even last as long as it did. Little thin wires that flexed and went back and forth and all this stuff. And I actually saved, when I got the Walkman Killer, which was the first iPod I got back in 2001, I think when they came out, I did still have my last sports Walkman, and I just saved it and have it in a box and even pulled it out and showed it to my daughter one time. I feel like that's kind of like the equivalent for cyclists today of like, we used to walk uphill in the snow both ways to school. It's like, dude, we used to if you wanted music, it was like one and a half of your three pockets. You had your Walkman, you had a couple cassettes, you know, we would try and find the cassette tapes that were really long ones so you could load a bunch of music on it. And have enough time when you're out there riding. So yeah, it would take up like one and a half pockets just for music out on the rides. So it's pretty
laughing.
Funny.
I'm laughing thinking about how yellow was the default color for semi waterproof. So Minolta had a camera that was semi waterproof, maybe waterproof to 2 feet, and it was yellow. And I mean, where does that come from? Submarines? Like why did Sony have a yellow Walkman? But anyway.
Maybe yellow is what you can see when you're out in the water, probably the best, something like that, you know, submarines. Yeah.
And we did, to your point, yes, we would take our CDs and then record them onto a cassette. Right. So you could get multiple albums. Cause if you, I was never fond of buying cassette tapes. I'd always make my own cassettes off of vinyl and then off of CDs, because you could get an album on each side. Or if you got that Maxell 120, you could get like 2.5 albums.
Yeah.
But then the tape was super thin, so you had to be careful with the auto reverse, because those tapes were more fragile.
Right. Yeah. Right. The funniest story about auto reverse, KS, I'm going to tell a story of yours, is that the auto reverse sometimes would start to malfunction, and you'd be riding along and you're like jamming your tunes, right? Got whatever song set up for some intervals, and then it would flip and go the other way, and you're reaching back and trying to find the auto reverse button. And I remember, Kurt, you had one of those that was like kept auto-reversing and auto-reversing. And you finally told me the story how you were in between the two climbs of Casitas one day and it kept auto-reversing and you finally just had it. So I remember you explaining how you like sat up kind of calmly, opened up your Walkman, pulled out your rechargeable batteries, closed it up, unplug your headphones, and then just took that thing and just wham, just threw it against the ground and just smashed it. And then picked it up and then smashed it again and took off riding. And the funny thing about that is that there were some yellow parts on the side of the second climb of Casitas, if you're doing it the traditional way, for a while. I think one of them even got spray painted over when they came and did the, did the paint stripes on the side.
Yes.
So, yeah.
I remember that very well. And I do remember seeing that piece of yellow plastic on the edge of the road for months. I mean, or maybe even an entire season. Yeah. It just like, yeah. So. Yes, I did. I may have left a little litter on the side of the road back in the late 80s or early 90s. Yeah. But eventually it got cleaned up. Yes.
So it's an interesting time of year. It's sort of the off season for pro cycling. But I noticed in the new modern media age, these media companies, Cycling News, Escape Collective, all the podcasts, they have to keep the news going. And also these pro teams, they're playing the media cycle as well. They're going to roll out their new sponsors, their new signings. They're going to time the market. Everyone has so much media training nowadays, and everyone is such a pro. So one of the big news, is that we have a new American pro cycling team rolling out their pro designation. So if you're not familiar with UCI, you have World Tour, Pro, and then Continental. Is that correct, KS?
It was at some point. I just like to say like level one, level two, level three, which is World Tour. Yeah, it used to be Pro, Continental, and Continental. I'm not sure of the exact designation, but yes, they're in the middle tier, which are like a lot of the French teams that get invites to the Tour because they're French teams, and they're not World Tour teams that get the automatic invites. And the financial obligations are a lot less for a team like that, but you can still get invites to bigger events.
So Hincapie's new team with Lance lurking in the background. I'm sorry. I'm sure Lance lurks in the background. I'm probably not supposed to say that, but I'm sure he does.
First Amendment, say whatever you want.
Modern Adventure Pro Cycling. They're pro. So those riders have guaranteed 2-year contracts?
I'm not sure on the contract duration, but there is, I believe, a minimum salary requirement for the riders.
I think they all, I heard they signed 2-year contracts. I think all of them except for maybe one, and that they are the minimum contract amount,
Yeah.
So the bank guarantees were made contracts were signed, allegedly. I think five or seven of the riders come from what's the name of that team that was around last year? I'm drawing a blank. That they come from the top American team. So Echelon, Project Echelon. So you got Sam Boardman, Scott McGill, you got four or five riders coming from that team. So it kind of changes the landscape. It's a shift of where the riders are going to be next year and the events that they're doing.
I mean, it appears to me that it is definitely a development team. You can say what you want, but if you don't have the money to really get the infrastructure in place. And I do believe the Hind Cabbies have had some infrastructure in place because they've had teams that were, you know, run domestically. And when Thomas Craven was running that program, he was running racing over there in Europe. And I'm sure there's a Girona connection. But, you know, it still takes a lot of money to get everything in place and all the vehicles and the people and the lodging. And yeah, so it'll be interesting to see money-wise, you know, how it all plays out. It kind of seems to me like it's a build it and they will come type of plan that's going on there. I mean, I don't say that with any knowledge, but I mean, just looking at it, you know, I don't know like what the net worth of that company is. So I think there may be a little, as you talked about earlier, there might be a little dark money in there somehow. But, you know, that's merely speculation based on relationships and history.
Yeah, and Modern Adventure is a travel company, so we need to probably pull up their website and study their revenue. They are a company that does, you know, exotic, fancy adventure travel, so maybe they're trying to build a brand there.
Well, I'd read about this in the press that this team was coming out, but I'll admit that I really haven't looked at the details too much, and what I'll say next is with respect to like cyclists who are getting a contract and team personnel who love cycling and are looking for a job, but it's hard. But I really don't have any time or space for the whole group of U.S. postal American riders who doped and never made any amends for it. And by making amends for it, I don't mean, you know, a lot of them served a quiet 6-month, you know, suspension over the off season and maybe missed a few cobbled classics at the start of the year. But for me, it's a matter of taking personal responsibility that if you do something. And so if you're, let's say you're born into a family that's in the mob and you go into that line of business, you could say, hey, I was born in the mob, but it also doesn't make murder and extortion. And so, you know, cyclists who, and I'm also not naive, although I was naive at the time when all of it was going on, I'm not naive at saying that if you were of that era, you know, it was really the sports governing bodies and the whole McQuaid, and I forget the other guy who ran it with him off the top of my head, that really set that up. But it's not a victimless crime. And it's easy to say, hey, everybody was doing it, so I can do it. And that's one way of saying it. But it doesn't mean that there weren't people that didn't dope that basically had to quit cycling. And I know this because towards the end of the 90s, one of my best friends who was a really top level amateur cyclist, he had a barbecue. He lived up in the Bay Area. He was working for a tech company. And I was up there hanging out. And a cyclist who KS was of our generation, maybe a couple years younger, and I'm not going to bring up his name because he never brought anything up. But he was an American and he was racing. He had gone through all the steps. You know, he was more of an all-arounder climber and he was at the barbecue. And I rapped with him for a little bit. Hey, you know, how's it going? All that, but not a whole lot. But I just noticed kind of this look in his eyes that looked like, you know, his dog died or just had that look like something, you know, had gone wrong. And I remember talking to my best friend about it afterwards. And I'm like, you know, what was up with, you know, this guy? And he just told me that it was the end of the season and the team that he was on just came to him and just said, hey, you know, if you don't get on a doping program, you're not going to get a contract. And he didn't dope. And that was the end of his cycling career. And so I think for all these athletes, and this includes, you know, guys who you watch on the tour like Christian Vandeveld, I'm not saying that they didn't have a decision to make, but to make that decision and never come out afterwards for the next generation of cyclists and say, you know, we made these decisions, but there were also negative impacts to people. I just don't have any time for them. And, you know, might not be a popular opinion with some people, but that's my opinion. And I think if you're being touted as fostering the next generation of cyclists, I don't think having somebody, you know, at the top of it who's, you know, refuses to accept responsibility for their actions and how it could have hurt people is just a positive image going forward. So I don't know if that means I'm just don't really care ever about it, but I would have loved to have seen all of those guys who were on postal and admitted they testified and came out and they served their short bans, a lot of them. But if they would have come out and said, hey, you know what? There were a lot of negative consequences to this. So we're all going to take just a little bit of all this money we made, because let's be honest, it came down to money. You know, if you didn't dope, you were either not going to get a contract, you were going to make a little bit of money and probably go out through the bottom end of cycling. And if you doped, then you could make a lot of money and get the publicity and have a TV, you know, TV commentator job. Take a little bit of that money you earned off your decision to dope and put it into a fund that would educate and help foster juniors coming along. You know, you can say what you want about Floyd and all of his, you know, how he handled his tour positive test and everything that he did after that. But at the end of the day, he did end up with about a $750,000 in his pocket after his whole whistleblower lawsuit, and he didn't keep it. He put it into a cycling team and sponsored him and didn't take that money. But I didn't see any of the other guys ever really owning their decisions.
Well, what an honest take that you're presenting, and what a, you know, it's an important topic. It's so easily brushed over. We're kind of in an era of a lot of cyclists just don't care about the doping time. They don't understand it. They see Dr. Peter Attia interviewing Lance and Lance going, yeah, I rode the Madone and da 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 da, and my watts per kilogram was 6.8, and you know, and they're like, wow, Lance was a stud, you know. And I don't know. It's just we're in a different era, and I think it's important to continue this conversation. I think there's some really good souls on this team. I don't know what to think about Alex House. He's one of the directors. He's a smart cat and an interesting character. And some of the riders, Sam Boardman is, a tried and true American pro, probably, a clean rider. And, we're in a different era, and there's some good guys on that team that I like seeing getting a contract.
Absolutely.
But it's important to continue this conversation and not brush over it. We grew up in an era where, Eddie Merckx was probably doping. I don't think LeMond was doing too much, but, LeMond has been, quite a champion for clean riding. But, I can remember when Scott Speaks tested positive, and, you and I, and we'd all just finished racing with him at Super Week and being tortured by him, and then he tested positive. So
Steve Speaks.
Steve Speaks.
Yeah. No, just to clarify for people, so they can look it up.
Yeah, but you're correct. And I'm not going to say, people might say, oh, it's a naive opinion, right? Because everybody was doing it, and that's the way that the sport was set up. And I even, over time, and I want to say this to give the opposite viewpoint, when all of this had come out, 10, 15 years ago now, and people would ask me about it, and I actually had an argument that defended, in a way, the people that made the decision to dope. And I'll say two things about that is, let's say you're in high school and you decide you want to be a doctor, a medical doctor, right? You want to be whatever, family doctor. You're like, this is my dream. I want to take care of people. So you go out, you go to medical school, which is going to be, 6 to 8 years. You got a ton of debt. You come out, you set up your office. You're like, man, this is my dream, right? I'm going to be working as a doctor. Wow, this is a lot of money. I'm trying to chip away at my debt. And maybe 6 months into your career as a doctor, you get a visit by some guy and he says, hey, I hate to break this to you, but it's really impossible right now to turn a profit as a doctor. Everybody makes up fake clients and bills and scams a little money off the top. And if you don't do it, you're going to go out of business. Your kids aren't going to be able to, go to the school that you wanted to pick for them. And if doctors, people who are doctors, were faced with that decision, I could see a lot of them probably would have gone, man, let me go talk to this guy who's been a doctor for 15 years. And you go and talk to him in confidence. He says, yeah, sorry to tell you, but it's the same thing, right? How many people would have said, well, you know what? If everybody's doing it, I'm going to do it too. But it doesn't mean that, like I said, that it's a victimless crime, And I understand that it's a business decision. If people remember Oscar Kamenzin, he was world champion, I believe, in 2003. And he ended up getting busted for doping back before there was any real, sanctions or criminal sanctions for it. And he gave the most basic, honest explanation. He just said, look, in the sport right now, he goes, I was given a decision. If I didn't take EPO and do all that, I'd make maybe $60,000 a year. He goes, who knows how long I would have been in the sport, and I would have gone out the bottom, never win any races. He goes, or I could dope and make, at that point, several hundred thousand a year, win big races and bonuses. And he said, I made the decision, I got caught, and now my career's over. But, that was his decision to make. And so I'm not naive in thinking that it wasn't a tough decision for people to make. And I could understand that if you have a dream and you want to be in it and you get in and all of a sudden you realize the system is corrupt, you have a decision to make. But like I said, I also think that there's negative consequences of that. And for all of those riders who are part of that to never just own it and come out and be frank for it, I think is doing frank about it is doing a real disservice to the next generation of riders, because you're kind of saying, hey, you know, don't own it, sweep it under the rug and look at me. I made all this money and now I, you know, have folklore in the sport of cycling. I just don't think that that's the message that you want to give to the next generation of riders.
What do you think about Chris Carmichael?
I think he never got caught as a coach, you know, but there's a lot of redacted information about him and, you know, built an empire on, I'm blanking on his CTS, you know, in doing that. And he was able to skate through. A lot of people did that, you know, and like I said, he never got sanctioned. So can you say that he did it for sure? No, if there's never any proof about it. But I think, again, all those people of that generation, if you don't ever come out and say, hey, we made decisions based on pressure, whatever, to do it, and here's some of the consequences of it, then how does the next generation learn? How do you effectively lead in that position? What do you guys think?
Well,
you
know, it's an important moment. We got modern adventures queuing up. What do you think, Kurt?
A big part of it, I feel, is it comes down to the broken model of sponsorship being the major funding of cycling. And cycling has always struggled for money, especially at that level, right? Like at the Pro Conti level. So anytime any money comes in, however, you know, little or great it sounds, people oftentimes, you know, decide to just kind of look the other way because the money's here and everybody jumps on top of it. And an example I like to think about in that is Rock Racing. If y'all remember the Rock Racing team and Rock Racing jeans, and right, I mean, they hired at that point Santiago Botero and who's the guy still racing the Colombian that's like 50 races the Tour Gila every year. They hired Tyler
Mancebo.
Francesco Mancebo. They just openly hired a bunch of convicted dopers. The guy who ran that company, Michael Ball, if I remember the name correctly, he was not necessarily an outstanding individual. But people were willing to look the other way because this little bit of money was coming into the sport of a sport that's so starved for money. So I think that's part of what's going on with this new thing, you know. I know George.
Well,
I don't know George real well. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, one thing about Rock Racing was they did rock and roll cycling, which it needed to be rock and rolled. You know, Michael Marks has come in and rock and rolled cycling with BWR. But Rock Racing did a good job of, you know, they brought some grit, some rock and roll, some good marketing.
Some flair.
They did that. I mean, right down to the rattle canned bikes, right? Remember the riders were painting their own frames and doing that because they didn't have a sponsor.
Really?
But yeah, I mean, there was all sorts of different stuff. But ultimately, you know, I think that also was a distraction too from, you know, what other stuff was going on. And my point is that people in cycling often choose to look the other way because, oh gosh, there's a little bit of money. I mean, this is like, we haven't had a U.S. team for a while. I mean, other than Team Type 1, I think they're still Team Type 1. Like, they've been a Conti team for 20 years or something now and doing that. But other than that, like, we haven't had a U.S. team. And so people are so hungry for it, they are willing to, like you say, look the other way, which is unfortunate. So I do believe, you know, if we can bring that to light a little bit and just bring some clarity to it and maybe offer a different perspective, I think that can be helpful, you know. And, you know, I think it was you said, DS, it's like, oh, these young riders, Ed, you said they don't even know or they don't care. But it's like, how can you know where you're going if you didn't know where you came from? So hopefully a little bit of, you know, even the storytelling that we're doing and offering some perspective of similar situations can be helpful.
Yeah, well, I'm proud of us for bringing it up. I think we should lean into it more. I think it's important that the conversation takes place. It's fun to look at their sponsors. They're going to ride those Ecoy pedals, which is, will be interesting to watch them with us. That's the proprietary shoe and pedal system. It's a lot like us telling our time shoe and pedal story.
Ecoy bought that. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, I was not aware of that. That's always an interesting one for neutral support.
Big platform, low pedal sole to the center of the axle. Although they were talking about, and I can't remember because I was reading about those pedals. I found it pretty interesting. And they were saying it was, I think, 9 millimeters from the center of the spindle to the bottom of the shoe or something like that. And I could have sworn that one of the original times was 8.5. But I would have to go back and look at that. So,
I can confirm just lets that, you know, DS. That.
So 8.5 mils. So even all the way back, now we're looking at 35 years ago. Pretty amazing that those original patents that Mr. Bell designed and patented had that, had the biomechanics back then.
The bioposition of the original Keep Pro, 8.5.
Yeah. Yeah.
Then the Criterium pedal came out, which gave you better cornering clearance. And if I remember correctly, it was 13 millimeters.
Yeah.
13, but still versus, 2.5 from the original looks, 2.5 centimeters, not millimeters. Right. So, yeah.
The interesting thing is they have an interesting collection of sponsors, Training Peaks, Finish Line, Lube, Michelin Tires. Michelin Tires is an interesting one. Columbia, that's that Columbia jackets. That sounds like a Hincappy long time relationship.
HTC. Yeah.
Yeah.
Hammerhead, Columbia Sportswear?
Hammerhead, which is SRAM. So it sounds like they're a SRAM team. Defeat Socks. There was one other interesting sponsor. Oh, Eagle Creek Bags, which interestingly, Eagle Creek Bags is a company here from San Diego that was sold off to VF, which owns Vans and a lot of fashion brands. And then VF quickly sold off Eagle Creek. So I think there's somebody in Idaho who owns Eagle Creek Bags. But anyway, interesting about list of sponsors.
Yeah. You said, and they are on Factor bicycles, correct?
Correct.
Is that,
I don't see Factor listed on the website, but I saw a press release somewhere.
It'll be interesting to see how that goes with Factor's decision to get out of the world tour. If they'll put those resources into this team.
It's
not on the site now?
Listed.
Is it there?
It is.
Oh, it is.
It is.
Okay.
Yeah, and then they're also going to ride Black Ink Wheels, which is Factor's wheel brand.
It's Factor, yeah.
Interesting.
Okay.
Well, we'll have to watch the progress. And good luck to all the racers who are, trying to make it as pros, which, Kurt, you and I can understand that, right? You get a contract and you're doing everything you can to race and hopefully work your way up the ladder. So we're giving, good positivity to all those racers to follow their dreams and the people, support personnel, soigneurs, mechanics, all that, who have a dream of working in pro cycling and want to follow that. I just want to make clear that my opinions on the principles doesn't say that those people shouldn't be chasing their dreams either. So good luck to all of them and much success.
Absolutely.
So DS, I know you need to, run and we need to wrap up, but there's one hot topic that you can join in or drop off on. And that is that Keegan Swenson is rumored to be moving to Specialized, and everyone's favorite topic is gravel. So I thought maybe we would wrap about that for just a second, but DS, you want to drop off or join in that participation?
I guess whenever you have somebody that's absolutely crushing it and isn't on, although you could argue that Pawn probably has as much money, as anybody, which owns, Santa Cruz and all these other brands, but you would like to see somebody like Keegan battling it out, against, Matt Beers on Specialized. But when I brought this up to you, Ed, you made a lot of good points about why it made sense, for him to go over there. And ultimately, if you're Keegan, man, that guy is so amazing. I think grab your contract, take the money, help develop the bikes, do all of that. I think if you're an athlete and you supplant yourself up at pretty much the top of your sport, dude, big offer should come along. It is kind of amazing that they got outbid, you know, that Specialized was able to outbid Pawn. But I think you could probably talk a little bit more to Ed about why some of the reasons it really just makes sense from a personal standpoint and who the other teammates are for Keegan on that program. Oops, excuse me.
Yeah.
Yes, is recovering from bronchial something or other. He's
some bronchitis.
What were you going to say, Kurt?
I was going to say, DS, you've done a great job of sound like you were going to crack a couple times and start into a coughing fit, and you haven't. So
I had a few close ones. I'm going to the
bronchitis is getting better. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm going to the doc in about 3 hours to get this cleared up, hopefully.
Yeah. Yeah. It's,
well, so what do you guys think about the Keegan that, the Specialized?
I think that there's, which we've spoken about off camera, but I think there's a lot more than just a big paycheck. There's got to be some design opportunity, and it must be quite compelling, you know, because he's been with Santa Cruz, you know, come up through that program. They've built an entire program around him. Specialized has done, you know, year after year, they've built, we would call it like a mini program within the behemoth that is Specialized around certain riders. But it feels like that entire Santa Cruz hit squad probably wouldn't exist without Keegan. So, you know, that it could affect a lot of other riders, right? There's other riders on that team as well. You know, they've got a 4-rider roster, 2 men, 2 women, support staff. It'll be interesting to see if indeed Keegan does go to Specialize, if that program continues to operate at the level it has operated at without the best gravel rider in the world on that team. Right. Time will tell. Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, more power to him. And I think that to the point you're making also, it's like the amount of time you have at the top level of the game, like for a guy like that, is so limited as far as like the entire time span of your life that, yeah, you got to be able to take advantage of it, because you never know when that burnout can happen. I mean, it can slowly over time. It can happen with a snap of the fingers, you know. You can have a collision with an e-bike out on a training ride. Who knows? So,
well, I think we already started to see chinks in his armor. Like, he didn't race well at Cape Epic. He, you know, dug super deep to win at Sea Otter, so deep that he, you know, projectile vomited at the finish line to beat Matt Veers. I think, you know, and he didn't win the Grand Prix this year. So we're seeing, you know, chinks in his armor. There was a year when he rode the Worlds for the U.S. road team in Australia. Yeah. And at that point, I would say, to be honest, I'm going to call that his peak right around those years. I'd say he's already slightly peaking. You know, maybe with a little more diverse support and precise focus, he can win the Grand Prix again. He is marathon world champion. He will wear the rainbow stripes in any mountain bike race over 50 miles. And I'm sure Specialized is interested in his marketing on the mountain bike as well, on the XCO bike. You know, one thing to point out is that the Crux is getting old. It needs to be redesigned. It does not have internal routing. It has fairly good clearance. It does have a UDH hanger this last year, but their whole gravel line is in need of a revamp, and the Crux is their bike. And Specialized markets the Tarmac with Sagan, now the Tarmac with Remco. They need a marquee rider to roll out a new Crux, probably at Sea Otter, right?
Yeah.
So and Specialized tends to revamp their whole line as a whole, so they'll have shoes, pedals, and helmets and everything, you know, around a marquee athlete, if this is true, this rumor is true. So, you know, it could be exciting and interesting to watch if it's in fact true. I don't think Escape Collective, who broke the rumor, put something out without vetting their sources. Although, you know, there has been a time where they were wrong about something recently, but it'll be interesting to watch.
You know, one more positive probably for Keegan on this, and you brought it up, if you mentioned, you know, Sagan, who still does PR work for Specialized, is for Keegan, I'm sure for a long term, you're talking about him hitting his peak at racing and then coming down. Hopefully it will be something where he can kind of be their gravel face for years to come, right? Just like Ned is still sponsored by Specialized. And I know when the last time Ned pinned on a pro number, which I think is great. I think, you know, I think companies should do that and carry those athletes forward. So hopefully for Keegan, that will work out for him.
Yeah, it's important to understand that his wife is on that team and he's very close with Matt Beers. I think him and Matt, you know, got to know each other well at Cape Epic when Keegan was suffering. And then I noticed that it looked like they split the prize money at Levi's Grand Fondo with a little working together. And so they do have a good relationship. But does create a super team in the first super team. And there's some debate about teams and how that's all changing. We're getting that Traca winner coming to the Lifetime Grand Prix. That guy, Swenson, no, what's his last name? He is like kind of a multi-compact Dutchy name. That guy's going to be a player, and there's going to be some changes in the Lifetime Grand Prix and some, you know, some bigger teams. So,
that's and maybe, to watch.
Maybe Alexi Vermeulen will go to Santa Cruz.
Ah, to be determined.
That's a nice little thought, little tidbit on that one.
Yeah.
Well, it is an interesting marketing opportunity too, the whole husband wife thing with Specialized. It'd be interesting to see if they lean into that at all. If one thing Specialized has always been really good at is the marketing side of things. You know, they're a marketing company that also makes great products. So it'll be fun to see how that at all comes to fruition.
Yeah. Service Course Report will be at Sea Otter reporting on everything at the first round of the season. First round race of the season.
The Fireside Chat will break this down nightly.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
Well, thank you. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for episode 12. Your comments, your like, your sharing help us grow. We're really trying to grow this, so we need the support of our listeners to help grow it. We're looking for sponsors. We're looking for your comments. We're looking for your likes and shares. And your feedback. So let us know how we're doing, what we can do better. And thanks for joining us today.
All right. Yep. Thanks.
See you guys.